The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Bizarre.
Bazan. Bazan. Bazan.
Bazan. Bazan. Bazan. Bazan. Bazan.
This is Bazan, the Bazaar, and we're Fiction Podcast with me, your host, Mr. Frank. Zongers, are you all stuffed up on turkey? Still recovering from that Thanksgiving Day feast? Wonderful. I've got the cure for you on your Monday blues. Back to work, Zongers. And I'm going to help make it nice and easy for you this Monday as we head back to work. The holiday season is upon us, Zongers. This is that weird time for podcasting. Most of your favorite podcasts, well, they'll start playing best of episodes and replays and stuff, and in all fairness, in the past, Bazong, your pal, Mr. Frank, has taken the winter holiday Christmas hiatus for a couple of weeks, leaving you with zero episodes of Bazong for the holidays, which, you know, I do it for a number of reasons. A lot of people just aren't available around that time of year. A lot of podcasts, like I just said, are kind of shut down during that time, and for me too. I just like to be shut down and enjoy the holidays and family and friends. And I think if putting out episodes of Bazong out there is a bit irresponsible. It's like, I don't want to take you away from that time. Of course, they're podcasts, and they will always be here waiting for you when you're ready. But it's sort of just the principle of things, Zongers. So I haven't nailed down my holiday schedule this year for Bazong just yet, but you can almost be certain we're gonna give everybody a bit of a Bazong break. Everybody needs a break from Bazong and from the world and podcasting and technology, and we just need to be around friends and family and having a good time, being sociable in real life, whatever that is. But Zongers, there is still much more Bazong to get to before we get to the winter holidays, and that includes this week's guest, the final New Bizarro Author Series author for the year 2018. Very happy to have this week the one and only Mr. Sean Koch, who is, he might be vying for the most enthusiastic interview I've had in 2018. He was very, very excited to do this interview, and that made it easier for me to interview him, and it also made it super exciting for me to interview him. He is, of course, a wonderful fan of Bazong. He is a Zonger. And so this was like his big chance. He's finally got his new Bizarro author book out, finally doing his thing, finally has a reason to be on Bazong, gets spotlighted himself with really good cause. As you know, we're talking new Bizarro author, but Sean's been around the block, ain't gonna lie. He really knows his stuff, he probably knows more than I do already about the whole publishing business and writing books and everything like that. So let's not let Mr. Frank talk about things. Let's get into the interview with the one and only, the final New Bizarro Author Series author for this year with his NBAS book, Crime of the Scene. Give us the gong. I'd like to welcome to Bazong this week the final release from the New Bizarro Author Series for 2018. We have him here, save the best for last, as they say. So welcome this year's final New Bizarro Author Series author, the author of the new book, Crime of the Scene, or the one and only Mr. Sean Koch. Sean, welcome to Bazong.
Welcome. I love the show. I love the show. I would like to see you write some more, but you produce the premier Bizarro source. No one interviews as many talented people. No one has a finger on the pulse like you. You're such a glorious person.
Oh, that is so kind of you to say. It's rare that I have guests that recognize the level of my talent and expertise that I bring to the show. So I'm not above having my butt kissed, and I will gladly accept those accolades. Sean, well, first of all, you may have been, I was a little worried. You were very excited / nervous for your appearance on Bazong, but it sounds like you're cool and collected and you're not gonna freeze in the headlights, as they say.
Well, I used to have social anxiety, and one time I avoided somebody's call for like a year and a half just because of phone calls, but a lot of hits of acid took care of that, so I'm not afraid of the phone anymore.
Oh, good. I don't think I necessarily condone the use of hits of acid to get over your social anxiety, but I can appreciate social anxiety. Guys, obviously you're not the only person in that boat, and people would refuse to believe that Mr. Frank himself had sort of a social anxiety in his early years, that it just took time and effort to get past that stuff. You know, we were all in school, and we didn't want to do those get up in front of the class and talk nonsense, and I probably took that sort of into my college years, and even there it was, I remember, like, I would write stuff for like the English class, and the teacher, I won't call him a professor, he was like an adjunct, so he was a part-time dodo. You need to read this. This is wonderful. And I just wouldn't read it. And he was like, how can you not want to read this stuff? I'm like, no. But now I do the wonderful Bazong podcast, and I have no choice but to be front and center and talk stuffs. But I'm glad, Sean, that you've dropped acid and you're ever-present here for this interview today. So
that's an icebreaker.
That is a good way to start things off here. So, new Bizarre All Series, as you know, Sean, being a fan of the podcast, I love talking to the new Bizarre All Series writers about the whole process, their experience with the thing, their experience with Garrett and getting a book and the whole history of the book here. So you're the last one I have for 2018 to talk to, and I don't know how many of you, I didn't get all of you, but most of you, and every story has been different. So tell me how Crime of the Scene found its way into the new Bizarro author series.
Well, of course, there was the workshops where I dealt with Garrett Cook on a number of workshops. And from that, originally, I had jotted down, I'd say in 2013 or so, I jotted down an idea, a crime scene that contains every crime scene in history. And that statement sort of just lingered somewhere in the back of my mind in my collection of like thousands of notes that I write down all the time. And when we went to do the workshop, it was like, oh, do you have any ideas? And I threw out a bunch of ideas. And that was the one that they wanted to go with. So I wrote it out. Originally, it was meant to be something like 80,000 words, because when I grew up, books were huge. They were big. You know, like fantasy sci-fi, they write really big books. Yeah. They're like, no, we got to cut this down to 35K because that's their limitation. So I had to like make it very streamlined.
And was that a bigger challenge for you than writing a longer thing?
Well, I mean, you learn a lot. You learn a lot when you realize you have a small budget of words. And I had dance routines, I had all kinds of stuff lined up for it, and I had to cut a lot of the excess fat. I think it's made it a lot stronger, a lot more centralized, it's focused. It got my work sometimes gets very bloated and goes nowhere. So I think this book really cuts it down to the cream of the crop.
Now, that explanation, first of all, the song and dance routine, I had to chuckle because that is just wonderful. I could picture that being into a more quote-unquote bloated book, or at least a sci-fi fantasy book for sure. But it does sound like the way you're talking is you're a new Bizarro Author Series writer, but it doesn't sound like you're very new to writing. How long have you been writing for?
All right, way back in the day. So in about 89 or 93, I used to read a lot when it was right going into out of elementary into junior high. And I wrote, but my father threw a lot of it away because it was horror. And he was one of those old standard Christians, like, you don't write any of that crap in my house. So in about 1999, I started a book called Turning, which bloated up to about 400,000 words. And I don't think anybody's ever going to see that without a massive rewrite to it. But, you know, they say a million words to mastery. And I think I got a lot of those out of the way. And so by 2010 or so, I had already done over about a million words. And then what happened was it was about 2010 that NaNoWriMo I discovered. And I know a lot of people have mixed opinions on it. It doesn't guarantee winners, but it does. It's like a workout for the brain to train yourself into daily writing habits. So I finished a book called The Bastard, and I put it up on Kindle, and it showed me I could just self-publish. It was horrible. It was unedited. The cover was a copyright-breaking Photoshop of a movie poster. And so that's gone. That doesn't exist at this moment. But it and the other seven books or so I wrote up until a couple years ago that were on Kindle all sort of got taken down, and I'm restructuring them to be in line with quality. I've got a real editor now. Because if I'm gonna be Eraserhead Press, which is the premier of bizarro industry, the like legacy company, I need to make sure all my other work, you know, is good enough to not drag it down.
Understood. So you're not new to writing, you're not new to publishing either, but everything, I guess it's just like this new bizarro office years is a chance for you to refocus, restart, and start doing things the right way. It sounds like you were, you know, at that dawn of the age of digital publishing, and anybody can make a book, and I'm anybody, I will make a book too. But you didn't do your due diligence. So now is your chance to reset it and be serious. Is that what's going on with you?
I'd like to say I'm new to people actually reading my stuff.
Yeah. So am I.
Back in 2013, I submitted a book to Eraserhead Press originally, and Kevin Donaghy took a look at it and said, like, we really like it, your prose is strong, but it's got too much pop culture in it. Because the book was about, it was the apocalyptic man with no name, Judge Dredd, except for it was Judge Judy. So she would go around the wasteland shooting people with, you know, six shooters and saying, like, ah, you call that frosting? Don't spit on my cupcake. Like, lines from the show. Because I work in television. I've worked in television for 8 years. And I watch a lot of Judge Judy and Dr. Phil and stuff. And every character in that book, it was a love letter to Eraserhead, because every character was named after a published author at Eraserhead. And it was like she goes across the wasteland fighting juggalo gangs and feral people in fursuits and believer nuns with chainsaw crucifixes. And they're screaming baby, baby, oh, as they scrape the chainsaws on the ground. And like, I'm gonna fix the book and put it out, but It was all pop culture, and they're like, you know, we already did Shatner and Quake, and like, we don't want to date this stuff too much, so write something else. And that's where we got to Crime of the Scene later, which I want to footnote that the Ready Player One came out and did the same gag, and they made like $1 billion on that.
Yeah, so who was wrong there, right? Look,
well,
you had me. You had me at it's Judge Dredd, but with Judge Judy. I am all in for that. So please. Please make that available to the world, because I would be all over that. It ain't too pop culture.
I'll send you a reader copy.
That would be really cool. So no, this sounds really awesome. That, you know, you're no, by no means a rookie, but you just needed to refocus. So, you know, when you took the workshop, I got to imagine from the sound of it, it wasn't just one workshop you took with Garrett. You probably did a few of them.
And turning around to look at my bookshelf, I've got something like 70 how to write books.
Does that work for you, reading those books?
It's kind of like this. You can find diamonds in a pile of manure. You can find tools in everything, and then you set those tools aside, and then sometimes they're useful, sometimes they're not. But it's not like any one book teaches you something. It's like every one of them tempers a sword. I don't know if you know how swords are tempered. They're folded and refolded and refolded. So all those books you add in, and it kind of – like I have 3,000 books in this house. I have just piles and piles, every genre, every type of book, and I just absorb the words. And it kind of like you're constantly refining.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I certainly have nothing on the in the scope of like 70 how to write books, but I've certainly picked up a few in my day and try to look at them. And some of them are, they seem like just outrageous. There was that one, it was like the Gotham writers, and it was like, yeah, you should come up with your character before you write word one on the book. You should know what's on your character's nightstand when he wakes up in the morning, what is on each shelf is in his refrigerator, and why it's on that shelf. Like, really deep character, like, and this is all stuff that will never be in the book, but you should know, by golly, as a writer. And I'm like, get the fuck out of town with that crazy shit. I'm like, do you understand the type of things I'm writing about? Do I need... And then beyond that, there's those people that are looking to make a buck, shall we say, on Amazon.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
And just like, hey, here's how to write the world's bestseller. And it's like everything everybody knows already. And they just duped you into getting those things. So now my thing is just like, you know, to roll my eyes. And I'm like, no, the only school is the school of hard knocks on writing is what I believe. So, but I do understand, like, in total there may be bits and nuggets, but for me it's not. I don't get those bits and nuggets out of book. I get those bits and nuggets out of doing this podcast, out of talking to other writers. What are you doing? You know, there's no one answer to being a successful writer, and what works for one may not work for another. But the more, you know, you find out what other people do, there's nuggets there that you can pick out and make work for you, I believe.
Wait, no. you have pantsers and you have plotters, which are people who just do it as they go, and then people who think the whole thing out. I mean, there's, like, you know, generally recognized two major ways of doing it. But, like, when I say learning to write, I look a lot into psychology, religion, stuff like that. I study, like, Joseph Campbell's Hero Cycle, of course. Dan Harmon put out a Hero Circle the other day. That's, like, the way a story circle works. Robert McCree's story. Like, I was into filmmaking for a while. I have a lot of filmmaking friends. So, you know, I've been over, like, how to do Hollywood scripts and stuff like that. And there's certain parts of it. I mean, obviously the three act or the four act that people are used to, but there's parts of it that are, they're universal in the human psychology. And when you understand those parts, like, everything else, you could just pretty much make up. And you don't even have to go with the formula. Like, there's a lot of great novels that go very off formula, but you understand why people pick up certain books more than they pick up other books.
So, working with Garrett and his workshop, you know, what was the thing that you took away from, you know, with him, outside of the, you know, the economy and words or everything, or maybe that is the lesson to be learned. What was your biggest takeaway? Because it seems like, you know, obviously doing stuff with him has made you, you know, want to basically hit the reset button on what you've done in the past.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's fantastic, but it's, with him, it was a lot of bring it in, make it more emotional, make it more focused on not just description, but make it alive. You know, a lot of books are written like they're dead, like, what's the say in Beetlejuice, stereo instructions. So you gotta bring it to life. And I think that's what he really helped me do, was find, like, the core of how to make it living and breathing.
Now, also, like, because you had that fantasy sci-fi style, how much of a departure is it being more bizarro for you?
I think everything I've ever done has been some portion bizarro. And I really got into Philip K. Dick a few years ago, which makes me sad because I should have got into it a long, long, long time ago. And his stuff was like a surreal nightmare. And I think that's, like, if I write sci-fi or fantasy or horror or anywhere in between those things, I want to make sure that it feels like a fever dream. And I think that's what ties it to bizarro. I think I've had criticisms. My one publisher that I work with, you know, he says, I don't like bizarro because bizarro is just lao-what random stuff just for the sake of being random. But that's not what bizarro is to me. For me, bizarro is pushing symbology into the narrative until the character's symbology becomes the narrative. So instead of, you know, like, you were like a fish, you are actually a fish. It's, I don't know, surreal nightmare fever dream. I'll stick with that.
Yeah, but then you have to you're not like a fish, but you are a fish, and you have to navigate this world that's built as a fish, and that's another big hitch, I think. Also, economy of words. Obviously, there's no such thing as a 1,000-page bizarro book. Bizarro books are very tight, compact things, you know, and that is often by design. I mean, how much of that was a departure for you? Because, like you said, you're used to writing these big 400,000, God bless you, word things. How difficult was it to find the economy of words? Because I can only imagine that is a quantum jump in difference of word counts.
I think the filmmaking study stuff really helped a lot, because in filmmaking, you shoot coverage. You shoot, like, you know, 9, 10, 100 hours of footage, and you end up at the end of the day putting out, like, 90 minutes. And there's a lot of cutting room floor, the stuff that's left. They're like, this scene didn't work. This scene didn't work. Here's behind-the-scenes stuff. We went with, like, three versions of this. And I think that it's the same sort of philosophies. You got to cut it down to what works. I'm not saying you can't write a 200,000-page bizarro epic. I'm sure I could try, but most people seem to prefer them to be in the smaller region. And I think that's because bizarro is more character-focused. It's more about emotions and who the person is. And I think it works really well when it comes down to about the edge of novella. Which I didn't want to bring it up, but my super idol hero, Carlton Mellick, of course everybody says Carlton Mellick, he's written long books. He's written some rather long bizarro books, but he makes it work because he knows how to keep it focused.
I can appreciate now, like you were talking about, like, I had these song and dance numbers all written up, like chapters of... I hesitate to use the word fluff, but chapters of fluff that maybe in a certain genre feel necessary, but certainly unnecessary in bizarro. And my experience writing bizarro is, like, it has to be concise. I find the longer the thing is, the harder it is to hold on to that bizarro element without it spiraling out of control. You know, that because things are so weird. And I think if you do go on too long, you start doing that just writing weird things for the sake of being weird, and being concise about that stuff helps to keep something you're writing from getting to that point of just writing it because it's weird.
Yeah. And while I was writing it, I'm writing the crime of the scene. I was reading Illuminatus by Robert Anton Wilson. And I was watching, what was that movie? Oh, The Devil's Carnival. Or Devil's Carnival? It was the guy who made Saw, went on to make a couple musical called The Devil's Carnival.
Okay.
And, like, that's why I was confabulating that all of them together is this sort of, like, non sequitur, mixed media. Like, there's narrative, there's first-person dialogue, like, all these different elements where it feels like you're reading all these pieces from some big crazy thing, and it goes off into dream sequences and then music sequences. Now, like, the full version would have been like that, but what it chopped down to is just a very character-oriented story about this detective who comes across a crime scene, and it's really kind of about his life and his personal background and his family and stuff like that. So while he's going through this, you know, the review of 10,000 years of human history and all the crimes we've ever committed and the behavior that repeats over and over with every generation of our civilization, it's also this story about one man trying to navigate the most messed up family dynamic.
You know, given that, it's also like, you know, you've been talking about, you know, a lot of sci-fi fantasy stuff, but yet the feel of the new bizarre author series, Crime of the Scene, it seems like a very crimey type of book. Is that something else you're into writing? Like, what is the core of this? Because it seems a departure from what you had been writing.
Well, let's see. So we did So I did an anthology collection with this person, Todd Foley. He does a series called Ubiquicity, and it's like a sci-fi transhumanist society where it's utopian instead of dystopian, because everybody's doing dystopian. And he's like, I want utopian. I want what happens when we have AR and VR and cyborg implants and 3D printers and stuff and the, you know, like 100 years of that. What kind of society is that? And every story that people turned into him was all noir, crime detective noir. And it's like that's the only thing people – because they associate with cyberpunk. It's not truly cyberpunk. It's not like dark and gritty. But that's all people's minds went to. People naturally gravitate towards that sort of noir detective story. But I love conspiracies and forbidden knowledge and occult and tinfoil madness. I collect them like a stamp collector. Like I put them in a book. I'm like, look, here's some crazy person said some crazy stuff. You know, like David Icke or Leary and McKenna and chaos magic, Gnosticism, all kinds of stuff. So the book is kind of a detective story. It's kind of a person, a character story about this character's life. But it's also got like Dante's Nine Layers iconography. There's Revelation stuff. There's a main antagonist called the Beast. There's Tantra-based cosmology like chakras. There's some Buddhist and Taoist stuff. There's Kubler-Ross grief model and the five layers of grief. There's a lot of Gnostic and Kabbalah. Specifically, klipothek or klipoth, which is a Hebrew word for shell or husk, and it means like a hollow mockery of physical existence. And there's this monster in it, because sometimes the word is pronounced kellypot. So there's this monster that's singing, kellypots, go away, no more kellypots here today. And the creature works as sort of like the Langoliers, eating this dead leftover, you know, remnants of the past as time is a constant moving through the sphere of cosmology.
Sean, you must be like the most literarily educated new bizarre
author. I wouldn't say educated.
Well, familiar, the most literally familiar, because how many decades did you just span? Decades, centuries did you just span in your last Langoliers? It was amazing. I don't usually have these in-depth conversations, and I'm the worst person to talk about literary history with. I'm really like, I've never read Philip K. Dick. That's awful. That's awful for me.
Oh, his prose is terrible. It's like pulling teeth to get through, but his concepts were just brilliant. He had the like best concepts.
I can appreciate, but like there's so much here that you've covered. You compact so much stuff. It's beyond
I mean, we're talking 10,000 years of human behavior.
Yeah, and you just like put that in one explanation, sort of speak. But it is astounding to me that like you're a new bizarre author, but yet like it does make sense because you had stuff out there, and you're just on the reset button. So
I was just always afraid to move over into actually making stuff like publishing.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, is this because of Garrett and the workshops and you found this?
Yeah. I want to give a shout out to Garrett. Thank you, Garrett. You really got me to realize I could actually do stuff and people would pay me for it.
That is a good deal. Now, the book, as we record this, isn't actually out yet. You know, peek behind the curtain. It's almost out. So you can't gauge for me at this point, like, how well it's done. But obviously, you're a person who's well read in Bizarro, and I'm sure you've read a bunch of new Bizarro Alt Series books. So I want to ask you about the new direction of the series this year. Now, I've asked it of everybody who's participated in MBAS this year, and I actually had a chance to get the from the horse's mouth, Garrett, just a couple of weeks ago about the new cover and everything like that. So are you on board with the new look and style of the...
Yeah, I like that they're personally tailored. Like, I like the idea because I have a bunch of the old ones on my shelf that were – they had the outline around it and a little picture in the middle. And it was cool because it was, like, part of a series. But, I mean, Bizarro is really about personality, and these new covers just pull that personality out.
I do like, obviously, I like the new cover. Everybody, I think, can agree that the old covers were ugly. If nothing else, there was sort of an ugliness to it, but there was a charm in the ugliness. But there was also a uniformity. There was something that branded, you know, it branded the books, New Bizarre Author Series, despite the aesthetic, which is now, at least from the front of the cover, because like Garrett said, there are all the backs who have that unified thing, yes, but from the front, they are all standalone looking things. They do not look part of a New Bizarre Author Series, and for better or worse. And there's probably the jury's still out on that, right? Whether, because in my mind, though I do believe the covers need to be more prominent, I still think there should be like a stamp, an emblem, or, you know, an embossment, a little gold sticker, something that says, hey, this is still
Nintendo, you know, seal of quality.
Yeah, got that right. That's what there should be some sort of thing like that, I think. But that's just me. I've been trying to sell this all year long. Like, I'm all into the full on cover thing, and the covers this year are spectacular. And I think it does help the books themselves to be the books themselves, I guess, if that makes sense, you know, like to be their own thing, where they were, you know, they kind of wrapped themselves in this look, that framed ugly green thing and everything. I think it helps to make them their own thing. But I think also just on the initial look at the cover of the book, there should still be something that you, little visual thing where you just see it and go, oh, it's also a New Bizarre Odyssey. That's just my thing, and I'm hammering it home again, because you're my last guy this year.
I can agree. Like some sort of watermark or something to identify something. It.
Yeah, something to that. And I, like I said, I've been asking these New Bizarre authors, and it's like everybody else, you had nothing to do with that. But, you know, you're the vanguards of this new style. So, like, in hindsight, as history will show, you know, whether how well it worked or not. So that's like sort of my pitch. And Garrett, you know, talking to Garrett, you know, there was just practicality of doing stuff like that. There were sort of limitations on it. And I think maybe as we progress from here, we might see something like that. But I'm definitely all for a very standalone-y looking covers. And your cover is, you know, that's the thing, is every cover is stark from the other. Like, there's, you know, like yours does not look anything like Larissa Glasser's, who I believe was this year's first book.
Which I love her book too, by the way.
Yeah, and or Liam Charlo's Fell Beauties is. They're all very stark from one another stylistically.
And my cover, by the way, not to interrupt, was done by this artist named Rob Martis, and he is doing an art collective out of L.A. called Nerd Pop, so there's a shout-out there.
Well, no, that's perfect, because I wanted to lead it. That's where I was leading into, like, because of the starkness. Obviously, you do have a say on, you know, what kind of artist you want to use for the cover?
Yeah. Yeah, that was a cool thing, is they were like, you know, come up with the art you want and we'll put it on. And the cover, I don't know if you've looked at it, but essentially the idea was Snakes and Ladders, which is not like a new game by Milton Bradley, but actually goes back like a long time to old Arabic rites and stuff. There's these old pictures where it's basically like a metaphor for the existence of life. And I crossed that. The snakes and the ladders with the tree of life in Kabbalah, because they're kind of similar in a way. And if you take the bars between the spheres in the Kabbalah tree of life, you end up with like snakes and ladders, and all the symbols represent all the spheres in Kabbalah. So like the hamburger is Malkuth, or I think it's Malkuth, which is the like the physical world.
Okay, if you say so.
I get on to occult stuff for hours and hours.
That's so cool. But I mean, for you to be able to know, to equate that. So, I mean, how much of that imagery on the cover is really at your direction, or how much of it was to the credit to your artist?
I gave him like, look, I want snakes and ladders in this shape, and I want these items to be these symbols. And he... didn't make it clean and clear like I had designed. He kind of made it all a giant mess that's falling apart. But since the book is about human culture over 10,000 years, it kind of is a giant mess that's falling apart.
I got you. So, you know, as much as it was your direction and your imagery from the occult and stuff like that, that's pretty freaking amazing. There was still he sort of took the chaotic translation of what you're getting at and put that into imagery.
Yeah, and I mean, that's like, you can't tell an artist. I mean, okay, I want to say corporately, you can tell an artist do this exact thing, but real art comes from what you feel. And if you do what you feel, no one has to tell you to do it. So I like artists to do that. Same as I like writers like myself to, you know, just write what you feel. Like Garrett and the other people at Eraserhead Press didn't say, you know, write this for us. They said, just tell a story that comes from you. And I wrote that. So I told the artist the same thing. Like, here's what I want, but, you know, make it how you see it.
I got it. I like that. Now, the other thing, too, like you just brought up, you know, tell this story and everything. And you had pitches. Were there other pitches you had, you know, for the workshop that?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so I just want to pretext this. Like, we could do 100 of these interviews and like probably a couple hours. So a couple years ago, I had this mad, crazy idea that I was going to do something called the 1001 Project, which was 999 stories cut into 333 chunks each. So that's 999 stories with a pre-cap and an end-cap, like a bookcase, and it would be 1001 stories. And the three poles of my storytelling are Wicked, Weird, and Wonder, with Weird being more science, like weird science, Wicked being horror, and Wonder being like more Alice in Wonderland naivety and fantasy in general, like things could happen. And so my stories always kind of revolve somewhere within those three. And within the 1001, I want to tell 1001 stories, and Crime of the Scene fits in there somewhere. It has a number. It has like a 0023, I think, or something like that. And then I have another book coming out that's releasing hopefully this week. I've got a friend who's setting up his own publisher, and we're going to try to get it out this week, called Liquid Hitler, that's about this detective who reads timelines and is able to solve crimes by navigating the alternate data of alternate realities, and uses that to track down a drug that turns people into racists called Liquid Hitler. It's got all kinds of crazy stuff, cat gods and demons and stuff going on. But of the 1001, I had like hundreds of these ideas of bizarro stories I wanted to tell. And I wrote them down and I list them. I'm like, what about Wankenstein? What about a story about a doctor who uses an Airbnb to lure college kids, kidnaps them, and films them having sex with monsters, and then he turns their bodies into the body parts to make new monsters, except for one of them falls in love with one of the big monsters, and they go on a spree across the countryside, and Wankenstein has to go get his monster back. And the monster's name is Big Dick, because, you know, like Frankenstein, but Big Dick. Then there's what if we did Cannonball Run, but all the cars were kaiju monsters? Cannonball Kaiju. I have this one called, it was originally called House Hunter, found out there was a book called House Hunter, went online and talked to the guy who did that book and explained my book and his book, and he was like, sure, you know, do your book, there's no real conflict there. So I changed the name to Valley of the Mobile Homes. It was about these like primitive cave people who live out in the plains and aren't allowed to live in houses because at some point in the past, houses became Cronenberg biological giant towers of meat, and they went crazy and the cities all spread in every direction and all these giant skyscrapers running around, and the people hunt the skyscrapers and then use them as these mobile fortresses. What's another one? Spunk Junkies, which is about a bank robbery of these three gray aliens who steal bull sperm because they snort the bull sperm and it gets them high. And this lady goes on an adventure with them through galactic space in their spaceship that's a taco truck that transforms into a spaceship. I don't know. I could pull up a list, but so, you can imagine.
There's no shortage.
It's like a flood. My mouth is like a tiny little rip in reality, and my brain just pours and pours, and I could write 1,000 of these. I just don't have the lifespan unless I just write every day.
Are any of them written or in the process of being written? Any of those ideas? Or are they just...
I have like 9 books written. They're all going through a reprocess to get put up through this year and next year. I have 3 short story collections, one of which is pretty much finished, 2 of which are kind of in the working stages. And then up on in front of me, I have 4 corkboards. One of them is an inspiration. One of them is a timeline. One of them has a specific book with scenes out of the book. I'm writing really focused on a book next year called They're Eating the Outside, about this Elon Musk-type billionaire who explores the astral plane and finds a woman out there and falls in love with her and discovers that the outer layers of reality, because reality is shaped like a bubble, the outer layers are being eaten by insects, which are these like dark clithopic or entities from outside, and he falls in love with her, and he realizes she has no body, so he can't bring her back to her body. And then at the end, he realizes she's one of the insects. Spoiler alert. But I'm working on trying to get that book out. But above me, there's about 30 different books, and I've got them all on little index cards. And I could see Cannonball Kaiju, Nail Bomb Vacation, Manly Manly Mustache, Digestion, Division 23, Middle Earth Finger, Unjudgeable, Kill Charles Bronson, The Bastard, Broken Cogs, like a ton of them. And it's just, can I get around to writing them? And then each one takes so much effort to try to get edited and cleaned up and get a cover for it, and I have no money, so there's all that. So the last year, I haven't done much because I'm trying to get set up someone who will publish my book, someone who will edit my books, and enough money so that I don't starve. And now that those 3 things are in place, like a conveyor belt, I can just pump material out.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, okay, there's a million ideas. How long is it going to take you to write, say, a Kaiju Cannonball?
And is it going to be good? But I use, like, so if you look back in the pulp days, they were writing, I don't know, like 10 books a year or something. Mm-hmm. You look at any of the prolific people like Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke, they were pumping out story after story after story. Of course, Philip K. Dick pumped out a lot of stories because he was on amphetamines, and I've looked into that. I don't know if that's going to be a good decision, but the reality is it doesn't take me long. From NaNoWriMo, I have learned how to put the process into about, for novella at least, below, I can do the entire book in probably about a week. And then it's like 2 or 3 weeks of editing. My goal right now, my metric is, can I beat Carlton Mellick? Which is impossible, of course, but that's where I set the bar right now. So if I could do that, I'll be happy.
That's a basically 4 books a year pace. Published 4 books a year pace.
Yeah, but, you know, whether or not they're good or just churning out, like the pulp era where they were just churning out the most generic formula cookie cutter stories. And I don't want to do that. I want each one to have like a meaning to it and a heart and be different from the rest.
So the stuff you pulled off on the shelves, and you're going to rework and modify and retool. Is there a plan for them? Is it back to self-publishing, or do you want to
It's self-publishing, but I have a friend who he does role-playing games on RPG drivethrough.com, mm-hmm. and he publishes them there. He publishes on Amazon, and he's taking he's an editor, so he's taking other authors and he's fixing their stuff up. And he said, "I want to launch an actual publishing company, and I want you to be the first like instable author, and so we're going to go through your projects and we're going to fix them up and get them live." And so that's where we are right now. We're working on the first one, which is ready to go live sometime this week, I'm hoping. And then I've got like the 7 more lined up to clean up over the next half a year. And then I want to start. Okay, so it's a official announcement. Any publishing houses listening, if you want an author who will just pump material out, let me know. I would love to be signed by full time. I'd like Eraserhead Press, but I feel like Eraserhead Press doesn't hold on to a lot of authors
that aren't their legacy authors for full time.
No,
and I understand the financial aspect of that too. It's kind of hard being a publishing for a niche like that.
Yeah, and I mean for the pace that you're pumping stuff out, they don't even publish at that pace, really.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what'll happen is I will die, and then my children will look through my collection and realize there's like 100 books unpublished. And you'll just see posthumous stuff just come pouring out.
Yeah, and that's where the real money is once you're dead.
oh, I know. Fake my death, then make millions of dollars, and come back out and say it was a gag.
That's right. You could be the Elvis of publishing.
Elvis.
Sean Koch, I am absolutely dizzy from interviewing you this week. You have so much going on. You know, with the new Bizarre Author series, you are by far, let's say, the most experienced is the best way to put it, probably, because you were kind of already there, but you had to refocus the train and get it all back on the tracks now, and you're using the new Bizarre Author series to do that, it sounds like. But behind this book, there isn't even a shadow of a doubt where you're going from here. You already have tons of material. It's going to find its way back out there, polished up and looking right now. So I don't even have to ask you the question, are you going to continue? Absolutely, you're going to continue. This is like your relaunching point, which is pretty exciting. Very, very different from any other new Bizarro writer I've had the opportunity to interview. And it's pretty exciting. And you know, I think we were talking off the air earlier about, you know, oh, hey, you know, I was at the end of the list and everything, but, you know, I say save the best for last, jokingly, but for sure, you have so much going on. Like you didn't need that whole year ramp up and everything, because this is just a springboard for you, and you're going to, it sounds like, explode from here.
Well, I hope I find an audience, but, you know, when you ask artists, why do you make art, and people, especially people who don't make creatively, they say, you know, why do you do this when you know you're not going to make money, you're going to starve, it's going to be miserable, starving artist. And the answer is always, because I can't not, because it just burns inside, and if you don't do it, you become miserable. And I write because that's the only thing I know inside.
Well, I love that. Despite yourself, you have to do it all. So I hope that everybody will start by checking out Crime of the Scene. It's available now as you listen. The final new Bizarre Author series book of 2018. It's definitely one to check out. And it's definitely a standout book from all the others. Like there's no two books that were the same this year, like at all. And I think, in total, when we look back on all the releases in the new Bizarre Author series in 2018, I think it's a perfect snapshot of like where Bizarro is going. And that is to say, like, God only knows, because it's all over the place now. There's really, it's everywhere. It's you can just not put your finger on even less than, and you know, that what is Bizarro definition that I early in this podcast try to point out, that it is, you know, I'll never get the same answer twice. And I think looking at the new Bizarro author series this year, you know, this is all curated by one guy, Garrett Cook. Well, and Rose and everybody's has a hand in it, of course. But, you know, you can see that there's no unifying one sort of thing of like, this is where Bizarro, it's everywhere, and it's beautiful, it is wide open. And we have Sean Koch's Crime of the Scene to cap it all off this year, and it sounds like 2019 and beyond is your oyster.
Hey, and if I'm lucky, maybe I'll be back. Huh?
Absolutely. When you put out all that stuff, especially when you put out the Judge Dredd starring Judge Judy, call me immediately.
Will do.
All right. So thank you. This year's final new Bizarre Author Series author, Sean Koch, for joining us on Bizong this week.
Been an honor and a privilege.
There he is, Zongers. he's smarter than me, the one and only Mr. Sean Couch. Check out his new Bizarro of the Series book, Crime of the Scene. Support those new Bizarro authors, Zongers, because they are the future of bizarre and weird fiction. And Zongers, when you're done checking out Sean's work, I'm sure you've got some holiday shopping to get done for yourself. So why not keep an eye on the Project Entertainment Network's Twitter feed or Facebook feed, or just check in at projectentertainmentnetwork.com and go over to the store tab, because there are sales galore, up to 30% off apparel and accessories for the holiday season. It is the perfect time. I know you sit there, you buddy up with your favorite pal, and you listen to Project Entertainment Network podcast all week long, and you're wondering, what do I get for the guy or gal who has everything? Well, what you get them is a Bizong hoodie. It's chilly out, Zongers. Your buddy is gonna freeze their butt off unless they get themselves a Bizong hoodie. So keep an eye out for those big Project Entertainment Network store sales and get yourself a Bizong hoodie and get one for your friend as well, so you're not left empty-handed on Christmas morning. Or if it's like Hanukkah, you got a lot of gifts to buy for Hanukkah. Like, Christmas is one day, one and done. Hanukkah, oh my God, what are we up to, like 50 days? The candles just keep burning, Zongers. You got to keep giving while the candles are burning. So load up on the Project Entertainment Network shop on merchandise from your favorite podcast on the network. And speaking of which, Zongers, the network that you know and love has value-added content over at their Patreon page. For as little as $1 a month, you can get access to podcasts from your favorite podcast on the Project Entertainment Network that you can't hear during the normal channels. You can only access them through Patreon, and it's only $1 a month. Shows like You've Got to Be Kidding Me, featuring Toke and Tom from the Necrocasticon. He's doing a conspiracy theory podcast with his buddy Skip Novak. There's also a podcast from Your New Opinion where they get really raunchy with their debates. It's a little too much, but it's all in good fun, and you can get access to that. You can get access to Mr. Frank's Not Bizong, where I interview the hosts of other Project Entertainment Network podcasts to find out what makes those podcasts tick, why they do what they do. And of course, there's access to, you could win show notes, you could win merchandise, stories, all kind of really cool stuff that you just can't get when you listen normally every week. So for as little as $1 a month, if you love the shows, you can get so much more if you have a little extra jingle to kick in for the Project Entertainment Network's Patreon page. Check that out now. That's patreon.com/projectentnet. And that's all we have for you this week on Bizong's Honors. So you are now free to go and listen to these other great Project Entertainment Network podcasts.
Three guys with beards.
The usual gang of idiots. That's me, Christopher Golden.
New York Times best-selling authors.
My name is Jim Moore.
Interviews with pop culture stars and creators.
I'm Jonathan Mayberry.
And they don't talk about politics.
Course of Human Events.
Jesus, let's not talk about the Course of Human Events today.
I said they don't talk about politics.
I suspect we may bend our rule about no politics on the beards and talk about politics on the beards.
Didn't you say they don't talk about politics?
If somebody else says something, we should...
Thank you.
Can anyone hear me? Am I all alone here?
Three guys with beards.
Tuesdays, exclusively on Project Entertainment Network.
Hello, is anybody out there? Anybody, this is Jim Cobb. If you're hearing this, the worst has happened. I've recorded a podcast at the end of the world and we'll broadcast it on channel PEN every Friday. It's all about the apocalypse, books, movies, TV, how much food and water will you need your bunker, all that kind of stuff.
Excuse me, sir. You're going to have to keep the noise down. You're in a library and you're scaring the kids. The world hasn't ended yet.
Sorry, ma'am.
Shh, you're in the library at the end of the world with host Jim Cobb.
Fridays, exclusively on Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.